Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Religious Exercise and Prison Inmates Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 2, 2010, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Sossamon v. Texas. The question in this case is whether a prison inmate can sue a state for money damages for violations of the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. To discuss the case, we have Jacob R. Lotion, who is an associate at Winston & Strawn, LLP. Mr. Lotion was on an amicus brief in support of the petitioner. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Lotion.
The Supreme Court this week heard oral argument in the case of Sossamon v. Texas, a case addressing whether prisoners may sue states for damages under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. The Act, which is known as RLUIPA for short, was passed by Congress in the year 2000. It was designed to carve out accommodations for religious exercise in two areas where Congress found religious exercise to be particularly threatened. One was land use regulation, and the other was prisons and other institutions where people are involuntarily committed. In the prison context, Congress observed that failures to accommodate religious exercise were particularly worrisome because prisons are highly regimented environments where the government controls a prisoner's every action at every moment of the day. So RLUIPA gave prisoners a right to reasonable religious accommodation. It provided that no government shall impose a substantial burden on a prisoner's religious exercise unless the burden is the least restrictive means of furthering a compelling government interest. But what remedies would prisoners have to enforce that right? Here, RLUIPA was less clear than it arguably should have been. Although RLUIPA indisputably created a cause of action for prisoners to sue state prison officials, it did not specify the particular kind of relief that would be available. Instead, it indicated that prisoners could sue for, quote, appropriate relief. And that left open the question about whether appropriate relief includes compensatory damages. Enter Harvey Leroy Sossamon III. He's an inmate at a Texas prison who sued Texas under RLUIPA for denying him opportunities to engage in Christian worship services. He was one of several inmates in disciplinary confinement who was not permitted to leave his cell to attend religious services, even though inmates were allowed to leave their cells to do other things, like attend educational classes and use the library. Sossamon and his co-religionists were also barred from using the prison chapel for religious services, even though inmates were allowed to use the chapel for various non-religious purposes, like marriage training sessions, sex education, and parties for GED graduates. So Sossamon sued the state of Texas, requesting both injunctive and monetary relief. The question on appeal, and the question now before the Supreme Court, is whether Sossamon's claim for damages can go forward. And that depends on whether it was authorized by RLUIPA's allowance of, quote, appropriate relief. So, does appropriate relief include damages? Answering that question requires the court to weave together three strands of its doctrine. The first strand is the traditional rule that if a statute is silent or unclear, courts may impose any remedy they deem appropriate. And when it comes to civil rights statutes, the unavailability of a damage remedy would be anomalous. The Rehabilitation Act, the ADA, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, the Fair Housing Act, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the Equal Pay Act, Title VII, all of these statutes authorize monetary relief. So why not RLUIPA too? However, the trouble comes when we consider the second doctrinal strand. Recall that RLUIPA, a federal statute, authorizes lawsuits against state governments. And in this case, Sossamon has sued the state of Texas, which operates as prison. But there's no enumerated power in the Constitution that gives Congress the ability to regulate state prisons. Congress gets around this problem, usually, by conditioning its regulations on the receipt of federal funds, which Congress has the power to dispense under the spending clause. If a state chooses to accept federal funds, it must accept the strings Congress attaches to it. And one of those strings was RLUIPA. The Supreme Court's spending clause doctrine has analogized this to a contract between the federal government and the state. And as a consequence, the court has required that Congress make clear to states exactly what they're in for when they accept federal funds. Like any contract, they must knowingly accept the terms of the deal. The spending clause, therefore, requires a level of clarity that is not required for an ordinary statute. In order for states to be liable for damages, RLUIPA's reference to appropriate relief must be clear enough that it puts a state on notice that it can be sued for damages. In two cases, however, the Supreme Court held that statutes less clear than RLUIPA did give clear notice of liability for damages. The court not only implied a private right of action in these cases, despite no express right of action, but also applied the general rule that courts may award any appropriate relief, and that such relief included damages. These are very helpful cases for Sossamon. But they differ from this one in an important respect, and the difference brings us to the third strand of doctrine in this case, the doctrine of sovereign immunity. While one might say that the spending clause protects Congress from itself, the doctrine of sovereign immunity protects states from everyone else. Under the doctrine, a state cannot be sued unless it consents to be sued by expressly waiving its sovereign immunity. Local municipalities, however, are not subject to sovereign immunity, and so do not enjoy this extra level of protection. And the two spending clause cases I mentioned above involve municipalities, not states. That's an important difference because the court has held that states do not waive their sovereign immunity unless their intent to do so is made very clear. Ambiguous waivers are construed in favor of the sovereign. So to sum up these three strands of doctrine, we know that damages remedies are often found or implied in civil rights statutes, but we also know that statutes enacted under the spending clause must be extra clear, and statutes waiving sovereign immunity must be extra super duper clear. Hence the question in the minds of the justices at oral argument. Is a reference to, quote, appropriate relief clear enough? Counsel for the state of Texas didn't think so. After all, he pointed out, the phrase appropriate relief simply begs the question of what relief is appropriate. But Justice Sotomayor quickly interjected to ask whether that argument proves too much. Nobody disputes that injunctive relief is available under RLUIPA. But if the statute gives no clue about what relief is appropriate, that would seem to preclude injunctive relief, too. Justice Breyer chimed in next. He noted that what we should be considering is the context of a statute. Sometimes language is clear when put in context, and sometimes not. Context, as he put it, makes things clear. That was exactly the point Sossamon's counsel had sought to emphasize. He argued that the words appropriate relief shouldn't be read in isolation, but instead should be read against the background principle that damages are considered to be appropriate relief in civil rights statutes. He also emphasized the structure, history, and purpose of RLUIPA to bolster his case for damages. It should come as no surprise that Justice Scalia wasn't buying it. He reminded us that the statute has to be clear about what liability states are subjecting themselves to. And he thought it's not clear with simply the word appropriate relief. Scalia focused on the word, not the context. Justice Ginsburg, however, was also skeptical. She was willing to consider context, but did not find the context so helpful to Sossamon. She noted that the Prison Litigation Reform Act precludes prisoners from seeking any damages against prisons unless they have suffered physical injury. So that statute is telling us that damages are not appropriate relief when there are no physical injuries, which rarely occur in RLUIPA cases. The limitation on damages imposed by the Prison Litigation Reform Act also raised a practical question over whether this case will have much real significance for prisoners. Justice Ginsburg wondered if the availability of damages under RLUIPA isn't simply an academic exercise, since the Prison Litigation Reform Act puts damages beyond the reach of most prisoners anyway. But Justice Sotomayor observed that damages can be very important, even if unavailable in many cases. Picking up on an argument my firm made in an amicus brief on behalf of the ACLU and other groups, Justice Sotomayor worried that prisons can too easily render a case moot unless prisoners can bring damage claims. By granting an accommodation to a prisoner on the eve of trial, or by transferring a prisoner to a different prison, officials can easily make claims for injunctive relief go away. Only a damage remedy can deter misconduct in these situations by keeping a prisoner's case alive. It's always difficult to predict a result based on oral argument. But Justices Scalia and Ginsburg seemed most sympathetic to the state of Texas, while Sotomayor and Breyer seemed most sympathetic to Sossamon. The other justices are anyone's guess. Just as we puzzle over the meaning of appropriate relief, we puzzle too over what, in this case, the court will deem to be the appropriate result.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.